from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, yesterday, President Obama unveiled a new initiative to map the human brain. The plan is to invest $100 million starting in fiscal year 2014 so scientists can create a roadmap of the brain's circuits, similar to the documentation done for the Human Genome Project. The initiative could develop new tools that might one day help treat diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and epilepsy, and it's being co-led by Stanford scientist Bill Newsom. But critics say there are no clear end goals and no set deadline, and that the money could be better used elsewhere. Experts join us to talk about what mapping the brain means and its potential for the future next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. President Barack Obama announced just yesterday a new $100 million research initiative beginning in fiscal year 2014 to understand the human brain by mapping brain circuits. The Brain Activity Map Project, officially named Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies, simply known as BRAIN, came out of an interdisciplinary 2011 meeting in London of neuroscientists and nanoscientists and will be led by Corey Bergman of Rockefeller University and Bill Newsom of Stanford as a National Institutes of Health working group under a partnership of government agencies and private institutions. Francis Collins, the head of NIH, has described the project as an idea whose time has come, and in this morning's opening hour, we want to find out all about the project as we discuss BRAIN. First, we want to go to Connecticut, actually Guilford, Connecticut, and welcome Carl Zimmer, who is a science writer and frequently contributes to National Geographic and The New York Times. He's a three-time winner of the American Association for the Advancement of Science's Journalism Award. Carl Zimmer, good to have you with us on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, this is being compared not only to the Genome Project, but the Moon Project and Sputnik. It is, in many people's minds, very promising in terms of what it can do. But at this point, what do we really know in terms of how it's going to unmap itself to map the brain?
Well, we're going to actually probably need some time to find that out because, as you mentioned, there's this working group that's going to be developing the priorities for this whole project. And this could potentially turn into something that lasts, say, 10 years and is on the scale of the Human Genome Project. But for now, Obama has made this announcement of this $100 million for this initiative. The way he described it at the press conference was that this BRAIN initiative, in his words, will give scientists the tools they need to get a dynamic picture of the brain in action. And so that's really ultimately what it's about, being able to see the brain in much more detail than we can now, in a sense being able to listen to the brain by monitoring its activity.
Well, there are about 85 billion neurons, as some count them, and we can only listen now to, what, about 1,000 at a time?
Well, it's actually moving up. I mean, there was a really impressive paper that just came out where scientists were able to monitor the activity in just about the whole brain of a little fish larva, which is tens of thousands of neurons. And so, you know, scientists are really stepping up and up and up in terms of how many neurons they can listen to at once. And that's key because, you know, what the brain makes us is the result of a whole population of neurons working together. It's not just one neuron over here and one neuron over there. You got to hear them all.
Well, what about the tools, though? I mean, a lot of them have not been developed. We have MRIs that can map the brain, but the resolution's not high enough.
So there are lots of different ways to map the brain, and MRI is just one. An MRI, you could think of it almost like as a top-down kind of approach. In other words, you can zero in down to, you know, in the neighborhood of a poppy seed of brain, that kind of resolution. Now, there are a whole bunch of neurons inside each of those poppy seeds, but that gives you a nice kind of satellite view, as it were, of the brain. And then, you know, scientists want to, you know, listen to the activity of individual neurons, but, you know, it would be quite challenging to listen to each and every one of them given the technology we have. It would be quite challenging just to listen to a million of them given the technology that we have.
We're talking, but I'm sorry, I just want to mention we're talking to Carl Zimmer. Please finish what you were saying.
Oh, yes, thank you. My point is that nanotechnology is moving really fast, and so scientists are inventing lots of really amazing devices, electrodes that you can implant in the brain, for example, that have lots and lots of sensors on them to be picking up signals all over the place. So we may not have the technology right now, but that technology is evolving at a pretty rapid rate.
Carl, I heard you on with Laura Shepherd on All Things Considered, Weekend All Things Considered, and you said there's really no way to know what mapping the brain can do. The president has been talking about it providing jobs, but this is going to be costly and complex, and there's a lot of, well, for lack of a better word at this point, kind of hype around it, you know, treating and diagnosing Alzheimer's, epilepsy, brain injury, memory loss. This all sounds wonderful, but we kind of have to think about what stem cells at first were what we were being told, don't we?
The thing is, though, that every really important branch of medicine, of biology, takes a while to deliver on the promise. And so, you know, you can look forward and say, hey, once we start to figure these things out, we might be then able to get new treatments for these a certain range of diseases. That's true. On the other hand, you don't want to deliver false hope and say, well, when you wake up tomorrow, you'll be able to go to the doctor and he'll have all these insights from this brain initiative and be able to have a cure for Alzheimer's. That's not going to happen.
Carl Zimmer, again, with us from Guilford, Connecticut this morning, who is an award-winning 3-time winner of the American Association for the Advancement of Science's Journalism Award. Bill Newsom is professor of neurobiology at the Stanford School of Medicine. He's one of the two people leading the working group in charge of the brain initiative. And Bill Newsom, good to talk to you again.
Michael, I'm a big fan of your show, and it's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you back here. Actually, I think I last saw you in Harvard with the Science and Spirituality Conference.
I think that's true.
Almost right after 9/11. Is this going to lead us into that kind of unknown metaphysical territory? We may not know where we're going with this.
It's going to be a big, big adventure, Michael. I don't think we'll get there quickly, but down the road, that we could go there. That could be conceivable. You know, most of us operate with the conviction as neuroscientists that all human behavior and all of our mental states and cognition are somehow rooted in the biology of this magnificent organ between our ears. And ultimately, those questions of behavior and all the way from how we simply walk around our rooms up to spirituality, they're ultimately questions about neurobiology and how our brains interface with the world and how we learn about the world through our brains.
Well, we need some well-defined goals, though, don't we, for this?
Yep,
like the genome or the moon projects?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, so our near-term goals are to stimulate research in a number of areas that seem very critical, very specific problems about how we perceive objects, how we learn, how we remember, how we make decisions, how we plan motor movements. These are the big questions in front of neuroscience right now. And the unique thing about this moment in time, as Carl said a while ago, is that we have really novel technologies that have been invented in the last 5 years that are suddenly going to enable us to go forward at a much more rapid pace. And the ones that have been developed are just the tip of the iceberg. There is realistic prospect for new technologies that are going to be developed over the next 5 years that are really sort of on the drawing boards now and starting to be, the individual scientists starting to pick them up and run with them, that are going to be even greater multipliers, so that this national resource that we've built of scientists and universities and private companies around the nation will take these same talented people but be able to make much more rapid progress and get a lot more leverage on these key goals just because the technology is going to act as a multiplier. So that's the real source of the excitement and why this moment is a very special moment in the history of neuroscience, unlike any other.
We're probably, though, just looking ahead, going to be looking mainly at Drosophila or fruit flies for a while. I mean, this is invasive research potentially on humans, so we need to limit it presumably to primates or not go into the human realm?
Yeah, I think that much of the basic technology development that we're talking about here, being able to record from hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of neurons simultaneously, those technologies will certainly be developed in animals, and insights that we get about how the nervous system functions in animals will, of course, be directly applicable to how the nervous system functions between our own ears. But I think at the same time, the committee is going to be looking very, very hard at ways to improve our current technologies for actually accessing signals from the human brain and actually being able to intervene and tune human brain circuits that have gone awry in disease. So I see this as almost a separate track that the committee is going to be trying to look at. And we're not going to say we've got to solve all these animal brains before we can make any progress at all on the human brain. I think it's very important that the committee take a long, hard look at the current cutting-edge technologies in studying the human brain and actually say, where can we do better with the development of these technologies? So I want to press both forward at once.
We're talking to Bill Newsom, who is professor of neurobiology at Stanford School of Medicine and one of the two people leading the working group in charge of the BRAIN Initiative. This is, when kind of crunch it down, Bill, kind of similar to the Genome Project in terms of mapping circuitry, right?
It is similar in some ways, and it's dissimilar in other ways, Michael. The huge advantage of the Genome Project, was that there was a very specific endpoint in mind, and you only had to work toward that one goal. A second big advantage is that we already knew the code. So we knew the code in the base pairs, and all we had to do was to link up the DNA base pairs to find what the whole genome looked like. Here, you know, we are uncertain what the basic code is that the brain uses to conduct its electrical business every day. And there may not be just one code. There may be a half a dozen codes, or there may be a dozen codes. So different brain structures, their electrical activity may conduct their conversation in different languages, if you want to use a metaphor. And we've got to get in there and find out exactly what those codes and those languages are before we can even begin to decipher them and understand how they go wrong in disease. So this is a more open-ended project than the Genome Project. And that's both a disadvantage, and it's going to be hard for us to come to you, Michael, in 10 years when I'm on your show once again and say, Michael, that goal was accomplished on time and under budget. That's going to be a very difficult thing to do because the brain is much more complicated than the genome. But still, we will be able to come back and say we have made substantial progress and we have new insights into disease and new insights into fundamental brain function, and here's what they are. I feel very confident that we can do that in 10 years.
It's also safe to say you need a time frame and specific goals, but you also need to make some cost estimates for these future budgets.
Yes. So we can do that. You know, my committee is a committee of scientists, not a committee of politicians and not a committee of sort of implementers in the federal government or in private industry. So we will come up with some general cost estimates that this particular capability seems appropriate to support at some particular level. But in the end, those decisions get made way above our heads somewhere.
Again, Bill Newsom with us this morning from Stanford is one of the two people leading the working group in charge of the BRAIN Initiative. I want to welcome Eddie Chang, who's Associate Professor of Neurosurgery and Physiology at UCSF. He's been able to map the brain of human subjects by actually recording the brain's activity while a patient is undergoing brain surgery. And welcome to the program, Eddie Chang.
Hi, good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. I also want to say good morning to John Nye, who's also with us. He's professor of molecular and cell biology and directs the Helen Wills Neuroscience Institute at UC Berkeley. John Nye, good to have you aboard here as well.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Glad to have you. And Eddie Chang, what have you done in your lab? You've had a breakthrough, really, haven't you, in this?
Well, I think that, you know, we've made fairly big changes in understanding about certain things that we think are specific to the way the human brain works. And I'm quite happy to hear that Dr. Newsom has specific emphasis in the projected aims for the new project for human brain recording. But there are certain circumstances, very extraordinary and rare ones. For example, when we have to map the brain in order to make sure that someone can come in the hospital and walk out, be able to talk and walk and be able to think. And the reality is we can do a lot of that quite well, but we don't really have all of the missing pieces of the puzzle yet. So I'm quite encouraged that this BRAIN Initiative might give us the resources we need, not only to make this surgery safer, but also to have a lot of spin-offs and use this very, very precious, exceptional resource that we have with our patients to actually learn about how the human brain does quite remarkable functions.
And you've kind of put out a caveat about irrational exuberance over this research.
Well, I think that, you know, we have to just, you know, think very carefully about how we apply what we learn from the animal systems to the human brain. You know, there's certainly no other organ in the whole body that is as specialized and highly evolved as the human brain. And we have a lot of examples from other systems like applied therapeutics and medications that have worked quite well in mice and even non-human primates that haven't actually translated well to humans. And certainly there's a lot of functions, the sort of critical cognitive functions of language and thought and memory that are actually quite unique about the way that the human does it. So, again, those kind of translations are not always directly relatable from animal studies. So I'm quite encouraged that the kind of brain mapping that we do routinely, let's say at UCSF, is part of our clinical care of patients, will become a broader part of this initiative. And hopefully we'll make some real tangible gains in terms of what we can learn from the animal systems.
We're talking to Eddie Chang, who is really a local brain mapping expert and also associate professor of neurosurgery and physiology at UCSF. The circuits of the brain really have to be kind of the language of the brain, as it's being described here, have to be measured in real time. And the new technology suggests that's really happening. But I'm wondering, can we really measure changes in brain chemistry? Is that ever likely?
Well, I think that, what we've been focusing is on electrical physiology, basically picking up the signals that are actually generated from the actual neuronal firing. And I think that, looking at chemical changes is definitely an avenue. Now, that may kind of restrict how we integrate some of this with human-level recording technologies, but maybe John can actually describe that more with the efforts at Berkeley.
Well, let me go to John Nye on that. Again, he's professor of molecular and cell biology, directs the Helen Wills Neuroscience Institute. You're pretty bullish about this whole research project, but what about the brain chemistry?
I'm definitely an enthusiast. I'm not ashamed to admit that. I mean, there have been, as Bill mentioned, there have been huge technological developments over the past 5, maybe 10 years that have allowed us to monitor activity in the brain in many, many different ways that we couldn't even dream about a generation ago. And some of these technologies, I think, are starting to push at looking at the how information is passed from cell to cell, not just in electrical terms. What are the transmitters? What's the currency that's used as one cell communicates with another? And what's gotten some of us here so excited about this is, as Bill mentioned, the technologies that we have today, which are just truly amazing, are really the tip of the iceberg. And what many of us, including the engineers that have been brought into the conversation, are really excited about is to develop some of these new technologies, some based on optical techniques, some based on chemical techniques, many involving genetics. And certainly now I think as we move into material science with the lessons that the nanoscience people and the nanotechnology people are learning, I think we really have the opportunity to make measurements in ways that we couldn't imagine just 5 years ago.
I'm just wondering, though, and let me get your response to this, John. Yesterday we happened to talk to Grover Norquist, and he was hammering Solyndra and talking about green energy funding from a very naysaying perspective. And there are some who feel that the Genome Project didn't really provide as much as had been anticipated or hoped for or expected. What can you say more to give more confidence on those kind of scores?
Well, let's talk about the Genome Project. I was a young lad. Well, I wasn't that young, actually. I remember when the Genome Project was being proposed, and there were doubters. I think it's reasonable to question and to ask, where's the money coming from, and how is the investment going to be made, and what are the potential benefits? And there are very few of us in science today that would look back now and say the Genome Project was a mistake. It not only gave us the code that is our human genome, but it tells us new ways of how to look at the code and how it's played out that makes an organism. So beyond just achieving that very discrete milestone of having the sequence of these three billion base pairs, it really gives us the blueprint, as it were, to understand how that sequence is used to give rise to life. So similarly, I think here there's a huge upside. There's always going to be some risk, and there's always going to be some cost, but I think we need to look at the potential benefit here. And those of us in the field, and I'm certainly an enthusiast, see the benefit as being enormous, because with, I think, a modest investment and a smart investment in the technology, we can really make great strides ahead.
Let me just, before we go to a break here, first give out our phone number, because you're certainly welcome to join us in conversation. I know many of you have questions or comments about this BRAIN project, so feel free to add your voice to the conversation. Our toll-free number is available now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can join us at 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls. This is interactive, so please feel free to join the program at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have directly onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. Bill Newsom, before we go to break, and then we'll hear from callers as soon as we return and emailers and whatnot, we're talking about what's been described as a dream team here. You and Corey Bergman from Rockefeller University have been named as leaders in this, but there's a lot of a lot of involvement, NIH, NSF, DARPA. I mean, can you sort of sketch out for us where the money's coming from and what the dream team is?
Well, I can tell you much more about the committee or the dream team. I'm a little hesitant to use that term, actually.
Too reminiscent of OJ, I agree, yeah.
Yeah, I don't view myself as a Michael Jordan of neuroscience or anything like that, and I don't think any other members of the committee do either. There was only one dream team. But this is an outstanding committee, honestly. Corey and I went through a process among ourselves to sort of decide the different fields that we needed represented, the different perspectives, and we sort of came up with our sort of top list of people, and there was a completely independent process going on doing the same thing at NIH. And it was actually quite interesting how well those two lists meshed in the end. And we each had lists of 20 or 30 people. I mean, quite honestly, you could go out and pick another 10 or 15 people out of the country that were on those two lists and have yourself a second committee that would be just as good as the first, I think. But nevertheless, we're extremely pleased with who we have, and it's got people represented from technology, people represented from computation and theory, basic neuroscience, genetics, and behavior. We have to have a heavy emphasis on behavior here, because behavior defines what we're actually trying to explain in neuroscience. So I think it's an outstanding committee, and it's representative geographically and intellectually, and it's I'm looking forward to working with these people. In terms of where the money is going to come from and whether there's going to be new money, I mean, this is a big outcome of the coming budget discussions between the president and the branches of Congress, and honestly, we don't know the answer to that. I don't think that we're asking for a lot of money here. I mean, as federal science spending goes, $100 million is not that much money for a first year, but it's like Professor Nye said just a few minutes ago, the right amount of money at the right time can have an outsized effect, because we're poised with these new technologies. And if we can just get the technical people working together with the neuroscientists in tight links, and this is one thing that the committee is really going to emphasize, that we need individual scientists who come from different disciplines to really commit to working with each other on these fundamental problems. And we need to go back and forth between the engineering lab and the neuroscience lab. If we can stimulate that kind of activity, we can turn this trickle of interdisciplinary activity that we have right now into a torrent, and I think it can have an outsized effect.
There's also, we're coming up on a break, Bill, but there's also the promise of immediate access to data, like the Genome Project. Public media and other scientists will get the data right away?
Well, that is something that we will be turning our attention to. I mean, public access to the data is very important, and we've got to figure out how to make that happen, I think.
Okay. Again, join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment, and you can also tweet us. Forum handle is @KQEDForum. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. More when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On Tuesday, President Obama unveiled a new initiative to map the human brain. The plan is to invest $100 million starting in fiscal year 2014 so scientists can create a roadmap of the brain's circuits, similar to the documentation done for the Human Genome Project. And the initiative could develop new tools that might one day help treat diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and epilepsy, and is being co-led by Stanford scientist Bill Newsom, who's with us this hour. Critics are saying there are no clear end goals, no set deadline, and that the money could be better used elsewhere. We've got a whole panel talking with us about it that includes John Nye, who's professor of molecular and cell biology and director of the Helen Wills Neuroscience Institute at UC Berkeley, Eddie Chang, who's associate professor of neurosurgery and physiology at UCSF, who has actually been able to map the brain of human subjects by recording brain activity while a patient is undergoing brain surgery, and Bill Newsom, whom I mentioned earlier, professor of neurobiology at Stanford and one of the two people leading the working group, and Carl Zimmer, who's with us as well, science writer, frequent contributor to National Geographic and the New York Times, and three-time winner of the American Association for the Advancement of Science's Journalism Award. We're going to go to your calls and emails in just a moment here. First, I want to actually bring Parto Mithra into this. He's professor of neuroscience and theoretical biology at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York. He runs the Mouse Brain Architecture Project, which actually maps the circuits of mice brains. And Parto Mithra, good to have you with us. Good morning.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
You have been more on the critical side here, and we've been hearing a good deal of enthusiasm. What's your concerns, or what's your skepticism, if you will?
I think you're referring to the Scientific American article I wrote.
I am indeed,
yes. It was a critique of a neuron paper. I would not put myself down as a critic of the broader initiative.
Well, forgive me. Let me quote you from that article in Scientific American, since you mentioned it. The problem with measuring every spike of every neuron is use of conceptual incoherence, is how you call it. The proposal doesn't stand up to theoretical scrutiny. End of quote.
Yeah, well, I was critiquing that particular proposal made in that specific paper. As you can see, where we are now is Bill and Corey and others are actually going to develop a reasoned proposal. I would separate those two things. What I was saying in the Scientific American article was there were some theoretical statements made in the neuron paper as to why it makes sense to, let us say, make recordings from a lot of different neurons in order to observe measure the emergent properties, so to speak, of brain function. And I was really trying to bring in thinking from physics and also theoretical neuroscience to sort of show that that didn't really completely make sense. I'd be cautious in sort of delineating where my critique lies.
Well, what are your cautions about this project, if you have any that are really outstanding to offer us?
I think a lot of my cautions have been addressed. Like, one thing is community engagement. I think there is a process now underway to better engage the community. Another concern I had that we don't get too narrowly focused on one particular scale or tool for analyzing the brain, which is a rather complicated system and needs to be approached from multiple levels. I just heard Bill mention behavior. We've been working hard at determining the anatomical circuitry recently. So as long as these different threads come together, and I think integration is going to be the key issue, then we'll be in much better shape. Initial media reports, there was not a lot of clarity as to what was being proposed, and there was this sense of this is about measuring the activity of every neuron in the human brain, which wasn't very sensible.
So you're not as concerned about incoherence here, then, even though you'd like the threads to come together?
I think there is a lot of fragmentation in the community, and I think that there is a role for theory and trying to think things through. The danger is that one develops tools without really thinking through what the tools are for, right? Namely, what the goals are. And I do think that there needs to be a discussion of those scientific goals, and I am quite optimistic that such discussions will occur. I think they already started occurring. Again, my critique there was directed towards that neuron paper.
Well, I thank you for joining us on Forum and appreciate your perspective. Again, that's Parto Mithra, who is professor of neuroscience and theoretical biology at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory and runs the Mouse Brain Architecture Project there, which maps the circuits of the brains of mice. Let me go to your calls here, and let me bring in a first caller from Sacramento. Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning. Hello. I have some of the concerns that the other scientists do have. I was an honorary scientist and turned down a research grant as a member of the team are post-Stargate members. And I was interested also in the public media connection, but being that this is not a democratic process and it's a process for people who are specialized, there are also specialists, say, people who have been studying the mind for nearly their entire life.
Did you have a question, Jennifer? I thought you had a question you wanted to ask her or bring up.
I do. And the reason I'm building that up is because the Stargate program did a lot of research on experiences of, say, collecting information of data of the public, especially dreams, where people actually dreamt of things. For instance, on my own team, we had one person who reported 9/11 the Wednesday before 9/11.
I'm sorry, I'm not able to follow you. I'm going to have to go on another call here. I got lost in that. Rich, join us. Hi, you're on.
Hi there. I had a question about glial cells, specifically the fact that they're so pervasive in the brain, and I was wondering if, and you know, their functions are just really kind of becoming known to us now. I was wondering if with this larger brain research that's going to be going on, is there going to be any focus given to glial cells and how they interact with neurons, how they support all these brain functions? It's really easy to focus on neurons and talk about them like electrical circuits, but there's a whole other level of complexity there, and I want to know if there's anything being focused on that.
No, he's asking about glial cells. John Nye, can you help us here?
Yeah, so as the caller astutely points out, the glia are probably, in terms of number, a very large proportion of what goes on between our ears. And there is a growing community of biologists studying the properties of these glial cells during development and also in modulating or directly guiding transmission between cells. So here, too, we do need tools to understand how they are modulating this chemical flow of information, how they modulate the neurotransmitters in the synapses, how they actually guide these synapses to develop, and how they ultimately affect their function. So comparatively, we're at an earlier stage in studying their role in the process of functioning in what we call neural circuits. And again, you know, what we're hopeful is that by providing tools that allow millisecond resolution to be able to, and with high spatial resolution, we'll be able to understand better the roles of all the cells in the nervous system and how they contribute ultimately to creating behavior output.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll move to another call, and that's Mike. Join us, Mike. You're on.
Hi. I missed a little bit of the program, but I was wondering about functional MRI and what role it might play. Incidentally, Tom Wolfe, who's well known to you, predicted in 1995, I believe it was, that this would be the most important technology, that is fMRI, in the 21st century.
Yeah. Eddie Chang, can I go to you on that?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to address that. We commonly use technologies as fMRI, and fMRI, just so that everyone understands, is a technology that uses MRI technology to actually study how the blood flow patterns change in the brain, and specifically the oxygenation status of the blood flow when the brain is working, doing certain computations that actually is involved with metabolism. And so there's no question whatsoever that fMRI has had a really fundamental influence on how we do human neuroscience. There are some really important limitations that we've realized, though. Some of the things that are detected with that blood flow actually occur on the order of minutes. And a lot of brain function, actually, the majority of actually functions at the, you know, on the order of milliseconds. So we're talking about several magnitudes of scale that are completely different for you know, something that this initiative will directly address, which is the real-time dynamics of neural brain activity. That is why, in many cases, it's required us to actually use the very, you know, rare and exceptional cases of brain surgery, that invasive approach, but in line with, you know, the goal of trying to protect our patients with that precious resource, to figure out both in millisecond and also millimeter time scale and spatial scale how these things are working, such as speech and language.
Well, let me thank Mike for his call. And I'll go back to you, Carl Zimmer, if I may. We've got a tweet here from a listener named Lorna who wants to know how this project compares to the Human Brain Project at the University of Manchester in the UK. Europe, I guess, has the Blue Brain Project, which does brain mapping. What are we talking about in terms of what's done there as opposed to what's being proposed here?
In Europe, there has been a large project that's been approved, and it's going to involve a number of different research centers. I believe it's on the order of about something around €1 billion or over $1 billion. And the idea is to try to actually create a very complicated simulation of part of the brain so that you would actually have a lot of sort of virtual neurons in a computer that were arranged with each other and behaving with each other as it does, they do in a brain, and that if it performs the way our neurons perform, then you could actually study it and learn something about some of the general rules about how our brains work. It's another example of big science when it comes to studying the brain. I might let some of the people involved with the Brain Initiative in the United States comment on whether this idea here in the U.S. is similar or different in approach to what they're doing now in Europe.
Yeah, Bill Newsom, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, the European effort, as Carl said, really emphasizes simulations and trying to reproduce biological-like neural circuits inside of computers. And I think the real point of difference with this U.S. effort is that most of us here in the United States don't think neuroscience is far enough along yet in understanding the basic biology to really do highly complex simulations and have confidence that, those simulation outputs are related to the biology. And we are really emphasizing here how much we need to go study real nervous systems, both animal nervous systems and human nervous systems, and acquire much, much more data. And we think that we'll get to deeper insights about how the brain is working that way than by a pure simulation environment. Now, simulations are important. Once we start getting these biological data, the real recordings from thousands of neurons at a time or tens of thousands of neurons at a time, exploring different alternative ways those neurons might interact with each other will require simulations. And Partha Mitra is one of the best in the business at this sort of thing, and he could speak to that a little bit better than I can. But I would say that the real difference between the European project and the American project is that we really want to get down into the brain and get those signals out and understand what's actually going on in real living brains.
We talked about a couple of big ethical questions that loom, such as human invasiveness and public awareness of what's going on. Here's a question, though, of a different nature, and Bill Newsom, I want to go to you with this and get your response to it. John, one of our listeners, writes, what are the potential negative byproducts of this potential research? It's still uncertain if the Human Genome Project will ultimately result in people being denied medical insurance or even jobs based on their DNA structures. Once it is understood how the brain works, will brain scans become a standard part of job applications, enhanced interrogation techniques, jury selection, highway patrol, road stops?
These are great questions, and that's why the president in his news conference yesterday said that he's directed his bioethics committee to specifically study ethical questions related to this brain project. I mean, these are very timely questions. Every question that has come up concerning ethics and potential uses and abuses of information in the genome project is also going to come up in spades in the brain project. And, you know, many of these are not new with the brain project. We are already manipulating brains in a sense, and we're trying to tune brains by the use of pharmacological agents. So every time a doctor writes a prescription for Valium or for an antidepressant, we are already on millions of people's lives, we are trying to tune the brain and change it for, hopefully, for good purposes. But those things, as we all know, can be abused, and it's really important to have this ethical component to right from the get-go to build this in and say, you know, where are the promises, but where are the places we could go wrong and have really negative outcomes, and we want to avoid those as much as possible.
Well, there are also a lot of questions about the money, and let me just give a sampling of some of these. Rita, for example, says, hooray, finally our money is well spent. And another listener says, a great move by the administration to stimulate brain research with injection of federal money. It will go down history as a great success. Science is a res publica, and when the government steps in, all obstacles fall. Example, the landing on the moon. And then you have other, more skeptical voices out there, or questioning voices, I should say. This is a listener, Eileen, who says, I feel concerned that we, the public, will pay for the research and they, the corporate nation, will profit. Is the committee being paid? Do they have ideas how the work will be parceled out? If there are patients as a result of the research, patents, will the public benefit? Universities, faculty, will we be able to track down the new findings? And Jonathan says, why is $100 million for this obviously beneficial project controversial? Who's worried about the end goal and wasting money here? I think we have more important programs to focus on if we're worried about end goals and wasting money. To put the $100 million in context, I've read the cost of the new F-35 Lightning II fighter is $157 million per plane to purchase the airframe and engines and could still go up. Eddie writes on Facebook, I question the timing of this. We need to have some agreement on government spending in place before we ask for $100 million for research, and we have the sequester in place now, so I think this idea will go nowhere. Another listener says, if this project is well delineated, how do the organizers know that the requisite budget is $100 million? Might be only $80 million or $260 million? How's the budget calculated? Is this not simply a money grab for a few groups? And if this is venture capital, then what alternative stimulus schemes have been considered? So you get the picture here, Bill Newsom. It's kind of a collage or pastiche of all kinds of responses to money. Some of them, frankly,
it's great to live in San Francisco, isn't it?
Yes. Well, the Bay Area in general, yeah. But you want to address some of those concerns?
Yeah, look, these are really great questions. One concern, let me put to rest right at the moment. The committee members are not being paid. I am not getting a dime for this. I'm just taking on another job in addition to all the other jobs I already have. And this is typically the way these review committees work at NIH. This is a purely voluntary basis. So you can put that one to rest. But, you know, the other concerns about what is an appropriate budget level, I mean, that's a great question. Is $100 million the right amount? I mean, what we're talking about is a federal base of spending on neuroscience research that's actually in the billions. And what we're talking about is whether $100 million well targeted at the right time can have an outside effect and develop these new technologies and the new intellectual power and computational skills that Partha was talking about, whether the right amount of injection at the right time can actually amplify this investment of billions that we're already making and basically get us much more product for what we're already investing. And that's the real hope.
I wonder about another listener's remarks here. Carl Zimmer, let me go to you on this. This is one of our listeners who writes, we must be frank with people. We must tell them that some research, important research, has to be done on cetaceans and primates who have brains as convoluted as ours. We can't make leaps from rodents to humans without the crucial link of higher animals in the concatenation of life to deduce meaningful laws.
Well, it's certainly important to study our fellow large-brained mammals. There's no question about that. And whales are actually really interesting because they evolve big brains independently from us. We both share a small-brained common ancestor.
Excuse me, Carl. I have to evoke Bill Newsom's definition of brain here: 3 pounds of goo in our cranium.
Yeah, and so whales got a lot of goo. But I think, though, in terms of insights that are going to translate directly to understanding how the human brain works and particular treatments, I don't think that kind of comparative approach will be a high priority. There's so much work that's been done on taking the results from mice or zebrafish and going straight to human brains that this will have to be something that scientists do on another track.
I got a Facebook remark here from a listener named Joffrey, who says, the brain is an electrochemical construct bathed in hormones and nutrients. Are we going to tackle easier items like motor functions before taking on tougher concepts like creativity and spirituality? And also, is there a distinction between brain and mind? John Nye, you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. The old mind-brain duality question. I won't go too near that. I mean, I think many of us in the field are reductionists, and we start by studying different aspects of nervous system function. Some of us study sensory systems, some motor systems, and ultimately some of us try to get toward more complex behaviors. I think these larger questions that have been with us for centuries, they may have to wait a little bit longer for us to get to, but I think as we start tackling these more accessible questions, by accessible, you know, how does the brain perceive and process sensory information, and how does that translate to motor output? These are actually biologically very, very complex, but arguably more accessible than getting at the larger issues of thought, emotion, consciousness. So I think this is all kind of on a path leading toward these larger questions. Whether they're solved in our generation or not, I think, is a very open question, but I think we have a discrete set of issues that we can start getting at and make real progress.
And again, John Nye is professor of molecular and cell biology and directs the Helen Wills Neuroscience Institute. Eddie Chang is associate professor of neurosurgery and physiology at UCSF. And question for you, Eddie Chang, from Nick, who says, I really feel uncomfortable with scientists reducing our cognitive functions to a series of algorithms and electrical measurements. The brain is plastic and is more than a machine in which data can be added and subtracted. It does not stand up to machine metaphors of cognition because we're human. We're constantly under stress and under the flux of altered perceptions and fallible memories that no technology can replicate or measure.
Well, very simply, I agree with a lot of that. I mean, I do think that it is in some ways a simplification to say that we can reduce the human brain to certainly the way we think about modern computing, you know, in 2013. However, I do think that there are certainly a lot of parallels in thinking about the brain as a large integrated circuit. And that kind of thinking and that kind of modeling that, you know, hopefully we'll be able to accomplish with the right kind of data to inform the parameters that inform that model will be available through these kind of initiatives. But ultimately, there are so many special things about the human brain, and I think that, you know, we start at a level where I think we can understand where we can have the closest correlations with observable behavior. That's the standard way of doing this kind of neuroscience, and I think that ultimately all of this is going to happen in parallel with the current approach in neuroscience, which is I don't think that we will stop trying to understand spirituality or language or cognition in general. These are all going to be happening in parallel.
And we go to another of your calls. Tom, join us. You're on.
All right, great show, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, we live in a profit-motivated and also information society, and you know, the president emphasized the financial, you know, maybe 130 up return per dollar invested. And, you know, we're also coming up near singularity, where this would all be obsolete anyway. I think artificial intelligence is able to, you know, be cognizant and reproduce itself and take over the world possibly. So this human brain is rapidly becoming obsolescence anyway. But also we try and fight. I think the emphasis on spirituality, you're mentioning that. That reminds me of a conflict we're having right now with the Muslims. All over the world, that maybe this is all, you know, DARPA involved is just trying to figure out the motivations and personalities and so on of the Muslims around the world so we can manipulate them. And we're not the only authoritarian country when it comes to, you know, huge prison populations and separation of rich and poor. You know, like, you know, we're China's, I'm sure, going to be interested in this technology in other authoritarian regimes.
You can rest assured that there is interest in this throughout the world, and I thank you, Tom, for those remarks. I just want to read another listener remark from our website having to do with the financial and cost, and a lot of you are writing in about specific questions about where the research might go, and I hope we can have time for some of those. But a listener writes, I understand the concerns about the cost in an era of strict fiscal responsibility, but let's put this in perspective. Total funding is less than the cost of one day of the war in Iraq, and the potential benefits are incalculable. We know so little about the brain, and this could be the equivalent in psychology of Isabel commissioning Columbus, ushering in a new era of research and advancements. If it even yields a single advancement, the benefits are treatment or prevention of a major mental health issue, the return would be immeasurable. But lots of specific questions, Bill Newsom, about what it can do or what it can't do. And at this point, we are pretty much in a new frontier here, aren't we?
We totally are. President Obama said it yesterday, that this is a grand challenge for the 21st century. You know, this is not just about FY14, right? It's about the next several decades. And this is an extraordinarily visionary project. And it's not going to be solved in my lifetime, but it is certainly going to have major effects in my lifetime. And I think that there was really electric excitement at the White House yesterday, and I think it's for very good reason. And I think a lot of scientists who were at that event yesterday went back home really dedicated to working as hard as they can to make the promise of this project a reality for American citizens and American taxpayers and, you know, for the citizens of the world, really. So I'm very optimistic about this thing. At the same time, we're all worried about the funding. The great bulk of neuroscience research in this country is done by individual scientists like those you have on your radio show right now, out working in their labs trying to do good stuff. And that funding comes through basic NIH budget, and we're all worried about whether that budget's going to cut, and the sequester is hurting very specific people in all of our departments here. And none of us want new money for the brain mapping project to detract from that key base of ongoing progress. So somehow or the other, we have to find a way to use the brain mapping project to amplify the effect of all these scientists working away in universities rather than detracting from it. And that's going to be a critical challenge for this.
Well, I wonder if there are those, like a listener named Mona who writes, says, my grandfather had Alzheimer's and I suffer from lifelong depression. I'm very excited to hear about this project. How can I donate to it directly? It hasn't come to the point of actually asking for donations, but who knows, right? At this point, I mean, you're looking at all kinds of possible revenue streams, aren't you?
Yeah, well, look, philanthropy is playing a major role here. So the Howard Hughes Medical Institute has started a major program in mapping brain circuits. The Allen Institute up in Seattle has started a major program. There are private partners getting involved here. This won't just be a government effort. And private citizens can donate. I mean, universities near you typically have good neuroscience research programs, and typically you can get involved in a neuroscience
program. Well, UC
program.
San Diego Chancellor has actually signed on a board just in terms of here in California already and made it available to those who want to contribute. It's a pretty exciting project, Bill. Congratulations on your participation in it, and thank you for joining us this morning on Forum.
You're very welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Carl Zimmer, for being with us. Enjoyed having you on as well.
Thank you.
And thank you, Eddie Chang.
Thank you.
And thank you, John Nye.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to all of you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.